This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. And today I'm delighted to talk to Dr. Shirali Tareen. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you so much for having me here, Paul.
It's great to have you. And I understand you're actually in London, as I am. And I do apologize for the weather. It's been quite dreadful. But it's a great honor to have you on Blogging Theology. And I'll just briefly introduce you. Shirali Tareen is Professor of Religious Studies at Franklin Marshall College in Pennsylvania in the United States. His research focuses on Muslim intellectual traditions and debates in early modern and modern South Asia. His book, Defending Muhammad in Modernity, received the American Institute of Pakistan Studies 2020 Book Prize and was selected as a finalist for the 2021 American Academy of Religion Book Award. His second book, which is the topic of our discussion today, is called, interestingly, Perilous Intimacies, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire. Now, the publishers of this book, Columbia University Press, have written about it, and they say, friendship, particularly interreligious friendship, offers both promise and peril. After the end of Muslim political sovereignty in South Asia, how did Muslim scholars grapple with the possibilities and dangers of Hindu-Muslim friendship? How did they negotiate the incongruities between foundational texts and attitudes toward non-Muslims that were informed by the pre-modern context of Muslim empire and the realities of British colonialism, which rendered South Asian Muslims into a political minority? In this book, Shirali Tareen explores how leading South Asian Muslim thinkers imagined and contested the boundaries of Hindu-Muslim friendship from the late 18th to the mid-20th centuries. He argues that often what was at stake in Muslim scholarly discourse and debates on Hindu-Muslim friendship were unresolved tensions and fissures over the place and meaning of Islam in the modern world. Perilous Intimacies considers a range of topics, including Muslim scholarly translations of Hinduism, Hindu-Muslim theological polemics, the question of interreligious friendship in the Quran, intra-Muslim debates on cow sacrifice, and debates on emulating Hindu customs and habits. Based on the close reading of an expansive and multifaceted archive of Arabic, Persian, and Hindu sources, this book illuminates the depth, complexity, and profound divisions of the Muslim intellectual traditions of South Asia. Perilous Intimacies also provides a timely perspective on the historical roots of present-day Hindu-Muslim relations, considering how to overcome thorny legacies and open new horizons for interreligious friendship. So that quite lengthy summary comes from the publishers, Columbia University Press. You can see it on their website. And it's a very interesting summary as well. And I read the introduction to your book, which I actually found extremely interesting, being someone who was very unfamiliar with a lot of the themes of your book. And that's been a great and very steep education for me. So thank you for that. So would you like just to introduce some of these themes in your book to us today, inshallah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you so much, Paul, first of all, for this invitation. It's an honor to be on Blogging Theology. And I also want to thank Mizanul Mulk, who's made this conversation possible. It's really terrific to be talking to you. I thought maybe before I get into the specificities of this book, let me just take a step back for your viewers and talk a bit more about the larger purpose of the kind of scholarship that I've done, since for the last 2 decades at this point. And what is the main sort of argument and purpose of the things that I've written? So in some ways, one of the main purposes of my scholarship is to highlight some of the complexities, the tensions, but also the depth and sophistication of Muslim intellectual traditions, primarily in early modern and modern South Asia, but even beyond South Asia for that matter. And one of the main ideas behind this kind of an intellectual pursuit is that in order to look at Islam in a fashion which is not monolithic, in a fashion which is not dehumanizing, in a fashion that considers the internal logics of the tradition, it's very important to approach intra-Muslim debate, intra-Muslim disagreement as an incredibly important site, regardless of one's own convictions, regardless of whether one is a Muslim or a non-Muslim. Mm. When you approach Islam as a tradition which is always marked by debate, disagreement, and different ways of understanding and reading the tradition, that helps us imagine and approach Islam as a dynamic tradition,
right,
as a tradition that is not marked by some kind of a monolithic ossification. And that in some ways is at the heart of the varied kinds of anti-Muslim bias, anti-Muslim racism, Islamophobia, of the sort of conservative fundamentalist varieties and also of the liberal secular varieties, mm-hmm. approaching Islam as some kind of a monolith.
Yeah.
And in trying to counter that, what I have tried to do as a student of Islam is to highlight these internal traditions of debate and disagreement, whereby regardless of where your own sympathies might lie, it's very important to think through these debates according to the internal logics and right. to consider their sophistication, their depth, while also their tensions and some contradictions and so on. So that in some ways is the underlying purpose of looking at intra-Muslim scholarly traditions with depth, seriousness, and with sympathy, while also being critical at the same time. Mm-hmm. So with that regard, as you mentioned, my first book was on this intra-Muslim debate, which has really cast a very penetrative shadow, not only over South Asia, but also over diaspora communities, especially in the UK.
Yeah.
And this is a debate which has its beginnings in the 19th century Northern India, but continues until today. And it was called the Barelvi Deobandi debate. It's between these two groups of Muslim reformist movements that emerged in the late 19th century, but that have really has represented to this day perhaps the most consequential and the most complex intra-Muslim and especially intra-Sunni debate in modern Islam. So my first book, Defending Muhammad in Modernity, was about this question of how did South Asian Muslim scholars, when South Asia lost...
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy. But being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care. And BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com today to get 10% off your first month.
Asian Muslims rather lost their political sovereignty.
Right.
How did they then engage in debates over the status of divine sovereignty and its relationship to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, his authority, and then the practice and everyday ritual life of the community? So it was basically conceptualizing the Barelvi Deobandi debate as two competing viewpoints, as two competing paradigms of this relationship between divine sovereignty, prophetic authority, and the everyday ritual life of the community, what I called in that book, competing political theologies. So that was the main argument of that first book. And one of my main motivations in writing that book was, again, to counter a very pervasive liberal secular viewpoint and approach to intra-Muslim debates in general, but especially to this Barelvi Deobandi debate in particular, to look at these debates as between what one might call the good Muslims and the bad Muslims, whereby there is this 19th century Orientalist narrative that, you know, for example, Muslim scholars who argue for the permissibility of practices like the celebration of the Prophet's birthday or visiting the shrines of saints and so on, that these are some of the Sufi good Muslims, the soft Muslims, that they believe in these kinds of popular practices and so on. And they are oftentimes contrasted with the the caricatured banner bearers of the Sharia or Islamic law, that Puritan kind of Islam, which is very harsh and does not allow for these popular practices on the ground and so on. And that has been the most pervasive way to look at this Bareilvi-Deobandi debate as well, where as the Bareilvis are stereotyped as, you know, soft Sufis, and the Deobandis are stereotyped as these harsh, you know, Sharia-minded people. And that kind of a stereotype became especially accentuated after 9/11, when it was revealed that some of the Taliban had also studied with in Islamic seminaries or madrasas loosely connected with this movement called Deoband, which is a much more expansive multinational movement. And then it, you know, what happened was in the post 9/11 context, you had these think tanks in Washington, D.C., like the Heritage Foundation, the Rand Corporation, publishing these incredibly shallow but very influential reports, whereby they said, okay, let's build Sufi universities in Pakistan as a way to undermine the threat of extremism and, you know, this Deoband Islam, which is more extremist and so on, which has spectacularly backfired, by the way, in ways that we can go into later. But yeah, my main attempt then in this book, Defending Mohammedan Modernity, was that no, this was not a debate between Sufis and Islamic legal scholars, because in fact, if you look at the writings of these two you know, schools and their pioneers and their founders, both of them, in fact, were major jurists of the Hanafi school of law, yeah, and they were major Sufi masters. Yeah. So it was not as if they, you know, woke up in the morning that I will be a mystic till the afternoon and now I'll become a legal scholar after that. So the ways in which we kind of compartmentalize Muslim life and Muslim intellectual traditions into these binaries, the legal and the mystical, the inclusive and the exclusive, the fundamentalist and the liberal. When you look at the internal logics and when you look at the internal sort of texture of these Muslim debates, they are a lot more complex. They're a lot more sophisticated. They do not fall that easily into these kinds of liberal secular binaries.
I just want to say, I'm just constantly staggered, reminded by your comments here, that often in the West can be very good at understanding the subtleties of science or Western philosophy, even political discourse in the West, the nuances of, you know, John Locke and Bentham and utilitarian. But when it comes to religion, especially Islam, nuance and in-depth analysis and understanding seems to elude us. You know, you mentioned the Rand report. I mean, these are serious intellectual analysts who you're trying to grapple with. And, you know, as you said, it's superficial and it's getting it wrong and it's kind of misfiring. And I just think this is such an ironic, really. The West, in some ways, can be very acute and very analytical. And in other ways, it really does fail to understand the basics of what is becoming the world, maybe by 2050, the world's largest religion, that it's still not getting it. And I just kind of throw my hands up in despair sometimes. When will the West actually have this? And of course, there are individual scholars who do, but mostly they don't, it seems. And that's just
that's a great point, Paula. And just to further punctuate your point, I just want to emphasize that these kinds of discourses and reports, they might be very shallow, but they're still very powerful, because they are the ones that then influence the State Department and their movements, for example, in different, you know, Muslim majority countries around the world. And at the heart of this whole kind of shallow discourse, which has a 19th century Orientalist history, is this liberal secular desire to present what is good religion. Yes. And good religion always is that which is compatible with U.S. foreign policy interests and a certain notion of a modern Protestant good religion, which is all about the interior, does not take that seriously practices and rituals or external forms of authority of scholars and so on, or Sufi masters. So it's a very particular kind of religion, which is interior, apolitical, which is championed. And then Islam is presented as the other of that good religion, that Islam becomes a paradigmatic religion that always threatens to spill over into politics, to spill over into violence and so on. So I think it's very important to realize this sort of broader kind of global politics of what one might call religion making, some kind of a making of a good religion with which then Islam is contrasted. And in some ways, my scholarship, primarily the kind of larger politics of it, is primarily to argue that when you look at the internal logics of intra-Muslim debates, this whole move to present Islam as the other of politics really does get undermined. So moving to now the book that is under discussion here, I just want to present the broader kind of
content
of my scholarship for your viewers. So in some ways, this second book is in some ways a continuity of the first book, but it's also quite different from the first one. In the second book, the continuity is that, again, I'm interested in the question of when a community loses its political sovereignty, how does it then imagine sovereign power? How does it imagine its capacity to decide, its capacity to exercise its power, its agency? And in the second book, Perilous Intimacies, I'm interested in the question of, from the mid-18th to the mid-20th century, as South Asian Islam went through this period of the gradual but decisive loss of Muslim political sovereignty and the coming of British colonial power, how did South Asian Muslim scholars debate the question of the boundaries of interreligious friendship and especially Hindu-Muslim friendship, and how that particular theme of debate became the grounds for the articulation of competing visions of Muslim sovereign power and competing visions of Muslim politics. And one of the main arguments that I make in this book again is that these intra-Muslim traditions of debate are incredibly sophisticated, are incredibly nuanced, and again, they cannot fit into these kinds of binaries of the inclusive and the exclusive, you know, the friendly towards the non-Muslim other and the harsh or the animus towards the non-Muslim other. So that's one point of the book, that these traditions of debate don't fit into these kinds of liberal secular binaries. And then again, more substantively, one of the arguments I make in the second book is that with the loss of Muslim political sovereignty, for some of the most prominent and influential South Asian Muslim scholars, the practice of everyday life, ritual practices that were a symbol of Muslim distinction in the public sphere, like cow sacrifice, like other sort of forms of practices, they became a key site for the exercise of Muslim sovereign power. Wow. That with the resurrection of a Muslim state no longer being a possibility, when it became an impossibility, the domain of sovereign power, that domain of life in which Muslim scholars could now exercise their power, exercise their capacity to decide on what is and is not Islam, and what should be the boundaries of the Muslim and the non-Muslim, increasingly came to reside in these markers of Muslim distinction in everyday ritual practices. But then there were other Muslim scholars who did not agree with this viewpoint, and they, for example, located sovereign power in the institution of the caliphate, the Ottoman caliphate, which was dwindling at that time as well. So this is just one small example of ways in which the site of Hindu-Muslim friendship became the arena for the articulation of competing visions of Muslim sovereign power in the absence of Muslim political sovereignty. I'll pause here and maybe we can get into the specifics further as the conversation goes along.
Yeah, you said in your book that this focus on the rituals and the practices of Islam in a day-to-day life became not a substitute, but it came as a focus because there was no longer political sovereignty, Islamic political sovereignty. This became the focus for identity and the relationships with Hindus and the controversies. And I thought that was very interesting. And also, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, did you say in your book that this early caliphate movement in India, for example, had non-Muslim allies, like even some Hindus, like Gandhi? Was Gandhi somehow an ally to this restoration of the Ottoman caliphate? And if that is the case, why on earth would Gandhi be interested in that political restoration of the Islamic caliphate in Istanbul? What's going on there, do you think?
A great question. So let me get into this case study. So this is an example that goes back exactly a century ago. So interestingly, Paul, 2024 was the 100th year anniversary of the fall of the, what for some people is the Ottoman caliphate, for others the Ottoman state. But some notion of the Muslim caliphate, the end of that happened exactly 100 years ago, and the formation of the Turkish Republic. So exactly 100 years ago, this debate gets precipitated in South Asia, a really intense but also very productive and interesting debate, again on the question of Hindu-Muslim friendship. And there was this movement that emerged called the Caliphate Movement or the Khilafat Movement that, as you correctly pointed out, collaborated with Gandhi and the Indian National Congress at a moment when Gandhi himself was leading a movement called the Non-Cooperation Movement. And the whole idea was that we ought to cut our civic ties with the British colonial government, and hence we will not cooperate with that government in any kind of domains of politics or other sort of domains of life having to do with, for example, taking funding for schools and colleges and so on. So there was an alliance between the Muslim leaders of the Khilafat movement that included some of the most prominent Muslim scholars, both those who were seminary trained, called the Muslim ulama or the traditionalists, and also some of the Muslim modernists who got training or were educated at Western institutions of learning. And the key question here was, or the key sort of argument that the Khilafat movement leaders made was that in allying with Gandhi and establishing Hindu-Muslim political collaboration and a certain degree of Muslim-Hindu friendship through political collaboration, we will be able to take on the British colonial state and hence salvage the caliphate, which is a very important institution and which is the fulcrum of Muslim political life. Yeah. And their main argument was that in the absence of Muslim political sovereignty in South Asia itself, the caliphate is the closest bet in terms of the resuscitation of some notion of Muslim political sovereignty. And the interesting thing there, Paul, is that for these Khilafat movement leaders, they did not make this argument for Hindu-Muslim friendship by making some kind of recourse to a liberal secular narrative of saying, oh, no, let's be good with non-Muslims. That's what the liberal thing to do is. But rather, their argument was centered on a particular reading of Islamic law, on a particular reading of the Sharia. And their main argument actually came from the Quran, whereby they cited these two very interesting verses in the Quran, verses 8 and 9 of chapter 60, called Surah Mumtahana, or The Woman Examined. And these two verses basically say that Muslims can engage in relations of friendship and goodness with those non-Muslims who don't fight you because of your faith, who don't aid others in fighting you, and who don't drive you out of your homes or aid others in driving you out of your homes. In other words, those non-Muslims who are not aggressive towards you, those non-Muslims who are not violent towards you, can turn to them in friendship. And then the next verse basically says that you are not allowed to engage in friendship with only those non-Muslims who do these things, fight you because of your faith, throw you out of your homes, or aid others in throwing you out. So the argument of the Khilafat movement leaders, like this very famous scholar called Abul Kalam Azad, who actually became the education minister of independent India after independence and was the youngest president of the Congress party of Gandhi. So his main argument was that in South Asia, the non-Muslims of the first variety, those who don't fight you in religion, are the Hindus. And then those who fight you in religion are the British, because they have colonizing designs over the Ottoman Caliphate. So it was these specific verses of the Quran through which he made a very legal and Muslim theological argument for why this kind of interreligious friendship is not only permissible, but in fact is the need of the hour. So the point I really want to emphasize here is that for someone like Abul Kalam Azad, if you look at him today and say, oh, here is the good Muslim who wants friendship with the non-Muslims, he in fact is not making his argument from some kind of liberal secular discourse of being friends with the non-Muslim is a good thing, but rather through a specific reading of the Islamic legal tradition. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the same scholar then argued that it is an individual obligation, the category in Islamic law, which is called Fard Ain, an individual obligation for every Indian Muslims to take up arms and engage in jihad against the British state. So here you have a Muslim scholar who today, for example, in contemporary India and elsewhere, is oftentimes heralded as this great liberal champion of interreligious friendship and so on. If you look at his writings, he in fact is calling for jihad against the British, and actual violence. So again, this is one example of a complex figure who does not really fit into some kind of a binary between the good Muslim and the bad Muslim, or the liberal and the conservative, and so on. Now, the opposing viewpoint, very briefly, I'll give you the opposing viewpoint to this argument to further punctuate this larger kind of case study. So the opposing argument came from many Muslim scholars, but perhaps the most prominent was this scholar called Ahmad Raza Khan, who died in 1921. And he is the founder of the Barelvi school in South Asia, which to this day is perhaps the most widely followed normative sort of orientation in South Asia. And of course, has massive following even among diaspora communities, for example, in the UK. There are many seminaries, for example, in the UK affiliated with the Barelvi school even today. So this scholar, Ahmad Raza Khan, because he's from the Barelvi school, which has very sophisticated arguments for why Muslims should celebrate the Prophet's birthday celebration, why Muslim saints should be taken seriously as charismatic figures. But because of these positions, he's oftentimes, and the school is oftentimes caricatured as the soft Islam, the kind of more porous Islam. But when you look at his discourses on Hindu-Muslim friendship, he in fact made the counter-argument. And his counter-argument was, okay, let's go back to those two verses in the Quran, verses 8 and 9 of Surah Mumtahana. And he says that, no, Hindus don't fit that category of non-Muslims who don't fight you because of your religion. And he proposes an experiment. He says, go to any town, go to any village and try sacrificing a cow and then see what happens to you. So it's very interesting, Paul, that now today we're living in, and we can talk more about the contemporary relevance of these intra-Muslim debates in a moment. But I just want to quickly, very briefly, sort of highlight and flag for your viewers that in today's India, for example, one of the major problems is this cow-related violence against Muslims and against Dalits by Hindu nationalists and their allies. So here is a Muslim scholar talking about this exactly a century ago. And his viewpoint was that, no, Hindus do fit into that category of non-Muslims who do fight you in terms of religion. And then he made the other very interesting argument that when it comes to engaging with the British, he makes this very subtle and interesting argument that you have to maintain what he called mere transactional relations, not substantive friendship, but mere transactional relations by taking funding for your schools, by, you know, gaining employment, you know, in their institutions and so on. And his counter argument was that Gandhi, by making an argument that Muslims should cut all civic ties with the British, no employment, no taking of funding and so on, that will in fact lead to the self-destruction of the Muslim community. Because already a beleaguered minority which has lost its political sovereignty, if they also lose jobs, if they also don't get funding for their schools, that will lead to the evisceration of that minority community even further. So he makes this distinction between substantive friendship and mere transactional relations. And finally, then he makes the argument that, okay, even if you go by the school or the official sort of tenets of British colonial rule, which talks about religious freedom, something like cow sacrifice is a very important part of our tradition. It is a very distinctive marker of Islam in South Asia. So by pressuring or coercing Muslims to cease this practice because of the sensitivities of the Hindu community, you, in fact, the British, would be undermining our religious freedom. So here you have a Muslim scholar who is steeped in traditional Islamic knowledge traditions, the Sharia. And he makes his arguments according to the Sharia. But he is also versatile and he's able to cite the doctrine of religious freedom coming from a colonial kind of set of categories. So you have the same Muslim scholar. He's not some kind of a, you know, blind traditionalist who is...
He's doing ijtihad, this sense of independent reasoning, and he's taken into account context and new factors, colonialism in this case and so on. So it's subtle, it's proactive, it's not slavishly following blindly a kind of tradition. And the idea of the intra, what you're showing very, very fascinatingly here is the intra-Muslim dialogue, how to respond to this situation in the way that it is faithful to the tradition. And there's a disagreement, actually. And well, I can't just cite the Quran, because that's the whole point. How does one apply the Quran in this circumstance, given the context, which is A, B, C, D, and E? So absolutely fascinating. Yeah.
No, absolutely. And interestingly, then the scholars on the Khilafat movement side, they in fact use the same idea of religious freedom. How do they use it? They say that, well, the caliphate is a very sensitive part of Muslim theological doctrines and Islamic law, and it's a necessity according to them. And so the British, by having these colonizing designs to destroy the Ottoman caliphate, is intervening in a matter of religious sensitivity for Muslims, and that is, again, going against their own principle of religious freedom and secularism and so on. So here you have two groups of Muslim scholars, engaging in an intra-Muslim debate on how these two verses of the Quran should be understood, among many other things that I'm sort of leaving aside for purposes of brevity. But they are equally versatile and agile. And as you put it, they have this independent legal reasoning through which they can bring in categories from the colonial sort of discursive economy to make these very sophisticated arguments. Now, your comment just now, Paul, alerts me to another key aspect of this book that this might be a good time to insert here. And we've had a WhatsApp conversation on this already, which is one of the other things that I'm really interested in this book, Perilous Intimacies, perhaps even much more deliberately than my first book, is that the Islamic legal tradition, what we today call the Sharia and the laws that come from it and so on, you know, it's very diverse. It has multiple opinions. It has all kinds of different disagreements and so on. But nonetheless, the formative period for the establishment of the Islamic legal tradition was a formative period that assumed politically Muslim empire. It has this kind of a background of Muslim imperial sovereignty. Now, of course, the logics of Muslim imperial sovereignty, they change from, you know, the Umayyads to the Abbasids and others and so on. So I'm not trying to make some kind of an argument about some monolithic pre-modern Islam. But nonetheless, when it came to Islamic law, especially when it came to these questions like interreligious friendship, non-Muslim, non-Muslim relations, for the jurists of the pre-modern period, those who are were at the formative stage of this Islamic legal tradition, they assumed Muslim imperial sovereignty as their political context. And it is under that assumption, which of course is very common among most pre-modern empires, this desire for sovereign power over other communities. And it is under that assumption that they then formulated categories like, you know, a protected non-Muslim, the dhimmi, or things like the aggressive non-Muslim, what is called the muharib, and so on. So these categories and these laws on Muslim non-Muslim relations presumed the context of Muslim imperial sovereignty, of Muslim empire. So one of the questions I'm interested in this book is, and this is applicable to multiple contexts, not only South Asia, but perhaps most punctuated in South Asia, that as a community loses that context of Muslim imperial sovereignty with the end of the Mughal Empire, especially after the 1857 rebellion, which effectively, you know, inaugurated in full steam the colonial project. So in that moment, with the loss of Muslim political sovereignty and with the loss of that background assumption, how then do Muslim scholars in South Asia from the mid-18th to the mid-20th century read, interpret, and engage with that tradition that had as its foundational assumption the context of Muslim empire? And my main argument is that these kinds of readings of the pre-modern tradition then are very subtle, very interesting, but then those readings have to also contend with a new set of conditions, a new set of categories, like religious freedom, the category of the secular, categories that come from the colonial discursive economy. And one of the things I'm most interested in is to look at the encounter, the interaction between that pre-modern Muslim legal tradition in a context which is no longer there, with this discursive economy, the context of British colonial power. And one of my main arguments is that this encounter does not happen on even terms. This happens on very uneven terms. That in order for these Muslim scholars to have their arguments get a hearing, for example, at colonial courts, for example, in terms of colonial policies, with regards to which areas in South Asia will cow slaughter be permitted and which ones will not, they had to engage with this very uneven playing field, this very uneven terrain. But nonetheless, although this terrain is uneven, these scholars engaged with that uneven terrain in some very sophisticated and interesting ways. And regardless of what our viewpoint might be, it would be useful for us to understand these traditions of intra-Muslim debate on their own terms in order to understand our present better, to get a historical understanding of the past, which has made the current present and Muslim non-Muslim relations in this present possible.
And I just, if I may, just quote a paragraph from the introduction to your book, Perilous Intimacies, page 18. It was I've mentioned this to you before, obviously on WhatsApp, as you mentioned, but very striking. And I was surprised in a way from a Western scholar, you obviously are a Western scholar based in America, came up with this very striking statement. You said, by positing the category of an imperial Muslim political theology, therefore, I do not wish to argue for any unitary political or normative vision of pre-modern Islam. You've just said that just now. You're not essentializing into there was diversity, there was difference. But nevertheless, you say, and yes, since sometimes it is better to state the obvious than leave matters ambiguous, let me also state explicitly, you write, that I do not mean to impute into the pre-modern Muslim intellectual tradition the liberal sin of intolerance. Apart from the sheer anachronism of such a gesture, it would erase the often far more violent and exclusionary politics of modern and contemporary regimes of liberal secular tolerance. Then you say, as I will elaborate further in the epilogue. And I just thought that was very interesting, because you have a critical distance, not only to your Muslim past, the Muslim past, the pre-modern past, but also to your contemporary liberal secular context as well. You're not simply assuming that as the natural backdrop of your scholarship and say, well, that's the kind of the normative position, secular, liberal, so-called tolerance. No. You are critical with that as well. And indeed, unveiling it as exclusionary and violent. Now, you might, a year ago, I may have said to you, what on earth are you talking about? But now it's obvious what I think is, we're talking about what's going on in Gaza and the West's ongoing cover for genocide in Palestine, and the suppression of any political dissent, which we can see on TikTok, on WhatsApp, we can on YouTube, of political dissent in Germany, for example, and France, and to a lesser extent, or maybe some extent, in America. You know, I've seen people having pro-Palestinian meetings, very respectable gatherings, not violent, very orderly, being gatecrashed by the police, who broke them up and arrested and manhandled people in Germany simply for supporting the rights of Palestinians. And that this is violent reaction against any dissent in a political order that claims to be liberal and inclusive and tolerant, but it's not. And it's almost as if it's been unmasked, unveiled now, once the power politics are at stake for the West. So I just want to say, I like the way you have that critical distance in both directions. You're not simply assuming the West as the normative backdrop to your discourse.
No, thank you so much, Paul. That's such an outstanding commentary you've just done. And one of the reasons why I had to put that sort of disclaimer sort of, One of the reasons is I'm the author of a second book now, so you sort of learned from the experience of the first book and anticipate possible misreadings and so on, and sort of thwart them while you're writing. And the other main reason is that, one of the most pernicious misreadings of this book would be the kind of a Hindu nationalist misreading, that by positing this category of an imperial Muslim political theology and then talking about ways in which these modern Muslim scholars try to reflect on what is Muslim sovereign power, one of the sort of very lazy but nonetheless pernicious misreadings could be that I'm positing some kind of a natural Muslim desire to dominate the other, or some kind of a monolithic notion of the, the Islam and Muslims who are always about trying to win territory through the sword, and this kind of a violent kind of caricature, which of course also has a very long Orientalist backdrop. And to really make the point that, when we look at this pre-modern past, first of all, what I'm looking at as a student of religion, as a student of what one might call Muslim intellectual history and traditions, I'm of course looking at the textual tradition, the Muslim scholarly tradition. And scholarly traditions and what happens on the ground, for example, between Muslims and non-Muslims, there are ways in which they might be congruent, there are ways in which they might also be dissonant. So I nonetheless don't want to shy away from the notion and the fact that the Muslim legal tradition did have a context of Muslim imperial sovereignty. So one of the sort of dangers, Paul, in terms of trying to confront Islamophobic or, anti-Muslim racist attitudes and viewpoints, whether they are of the sort of Christian or fundamentalist or the liberal secular varieties, is to go into the defensive and make it seem as if, no, we have never had anything to do with empire. It's always been peaceful and so on. And that defensiveness in some ways is also insulting at a level. So one has to be confident and not sort of whitewash any truth which might seem to be uncomfortable for a Muslim or non-Muslim that wants to, fit into a liberal secular narrative of what is a good person and a good Muslim today, or a good religious subject today. I'm so glad you brought the question of Palestine, because that in some ways really, I think, crystallizes and exemplifies this point that I make in that paragraph. And in fact, throughout the book, this is an undercurrent, that liberal secular regimes of governance are and have been a lot more violent and a lot more exclusionary than any religious tradition and its forms of exclusion or its forms of hierarchies and so
including,
on.
Including Islam, it goes without saying. You're saying this liberal, exclusionary, violent tradition, which is the dominant tradition of the West, is far more violent and exclusionary than the Islamic tradition throughout history. And this would be a kind of shocking claim to the uninitiated and uneducated in the subject. But I think it's well borne out by the facts of history, of course.
Paul, one thing we ought to consider here is the question of why is it that with the modern state, that might be any state, in this case, perhaps even, contemporary Muslim majority nation states, who oftentimes are, on the payroll of these imperial powers in any case. But why is it that the modern nation state, especially imperial modern nation states like the United States, like Israel, with their capacity of violence and with their execution of unprecedented, infinite capacities for the most gruesome forms of violence,
Why is it that one does not think about attaching the category of terrorism to these state forms of violence, which are unparalleled in terms of their capacity and in terms of their volume and intensity and gruesomeness, but that kind of an attachment, that kind of a label is only reserved for primarily Muslim actors who might engage in violence, oftentimes in self-resistance, for self-resistance. So I think this issue of Palestine really exemplifies this underlying secular conceit, whereby the modern state, which is seen as the repository of politics in the modern world, is given a blank check for violence, because that is a good kind of violence. That is the violence in protection of politics, right? That is the assumption here. Whereas violence emanating from non-state actors, especially Muslim non-state actors, is condemnable, is terrorism, precisely because that is seen as the other of politics. So the underlying assumption at work here is this binary between politics and violence, whereby politics is the domain of the modern nation state, and hence even if it conducts this kind of gruesome infinite violence, they would not be called terrorists. And violence then is the domain of the non-state actors, and hence that violence has to be curbed, condemned, and so on.
Just on that, if I just say, there's the American political scientist Samuel P. Huntington, of right. course. He was a political scientist, advisor to presidents, academic, very, very famous guy. There's an amazing quote from him. And he was no pro-Muslim liberal at all. But yeah, there's a very famous quote in his famous book. The West won the world not by the superiority of its ideas or values or religion, but rather by its superiority in applying organized violence. Westerners often forget this fact. Non-Westerners never do. And that's Professor Samuel Huntington, probably one of the greatest political scientists in the 20th century in America. And he knew the truth. And this is, in a sense, quite compatible with what you're saying.
Yeah. And just to relate all of this to this book again, is that, you know, when you look at, for example, Muslim scholars or even Muslim commoners, the underlying secular assumption, the underlying sort of liberal secular assumption of life, is that if religion is not contained, if it is not moderated, if it is not controlled properly by the state or by these non-state actors like the Heritage Foundation and so on, it will spill into violence. It will spill over into violence. Religion, at its core, is some kind of an irrational, unnatural phenomenon that needs to be contained, and that needs to be kept separated from this domain of life called politics. So with these kinds of Muslim scholars who I look at, the tendency might be that, oh, if a scholar like Ahmad Reza Khan is arguing against Hindu-Muslim friendship in the context of the Khilafat movement, this is the typical example of a Muslim scholar whose views are incompatible with any notion of politics, with any notion of the political. And hence, we need to sort of further the cause of interreligious harmony, interreligious friendship, through more doses, through more kind of furthering liberal secularism or liberal secular intervention in religious life. And what I'm trying to show in this book is that, first of all, someone like Ahmad Reza Khan, who's making an argument, and whether you agree with him or not, that's a separate issue, who's making the argument that no, when Muslims have lost their political sovereignty, practices like cow sacrifice, practices that have to do with the distinction of the Indian Muslim community, are in fact deeply political, because politics ultimately is the formation of the self, the formation of a virtuous self. If you even go back to the Greeks and this whole idea of the virtuous polis, it is about a certain kind of a ethical virtue, cultivation of virtue. And for him, that is contained in these markers of Muslim distinction. So that becomes a key site of politics for him. Let us not reduce politics to the modern state or to electoral democracy, but the political is a much broader sphere of life. And then secondly, if you're going to be suspicious of religious actors because they can always spill into, you know, exclusivism or interreligious violence and so on, then the first entity that should be contained, the first entity that should be seen with suspicion is the modern state, the modern liberal secular state, which engages in all forms of hierarchies, all forms of violence, all forms of privileging the majority population. I mean, why is it today, Paul, for example, It's fascinating. You know, I'm not, I don't follow tennis very closely, but I was looking at the Wimbledon scores the other day. And there is this Russian player called Medvedev. And on TV or on Google, basically, I was looking at the scores and I noticed that his flag was not next to his name. And that was a bit strange because he's actually a top seeded player, seeded third or third in the world, apparently.
Is it a Russian?
Exactly. And his flag does not appear on Google. It does not appear on the TV. And in all these Grand Slam tournaments, apparently in Australia, France, in the US Open or in Wimbledon, fans are not allowed to bring Russian flags into the stadium. Now, what an irony, because of the Russian war against Ukraine. So fine, you might condemn the Russian war and its transgressions as much as you wish.
That's the whole Russian people, isn't it? That's just the actions of the government of Putin. It's not like the whole of Russia is somehow...
Medvedev should not be blamed for the actions of the modern nation state. But more substantively, if flags will be now banned because of a modern nation state's capacity and execution of gruesome, unjust violence, the first flag that ought to be banned is the US flag. And the second flag that ought to be banned is the Israeli flag. And then we can come down and down on the list. And I'm sure organizations, I don't want to get your YouTube channel into trouble here, but I'm sure that organizations like Hezbollah, Hamas would be much further down on the list if you're going to get into the practice of banning flags on the basis of the...
I want to push back a little bit against it, just because some people might be... Your characterization of the West having this deep concern about religious actors, a concern about violence, and so on. There's a reason for this. It's not just some kind of imaginary fantasy illusion that the West have. The reason is obvious: Western history. If you look at the history of the Reformation in the early 16th century, beginning with Martin Luther and so on, you had an eruption. You had the breakdown of Christendom, an eruption of different sects: the Reform Christians and the Lutherans and the Catholics, of course, and the Anabaptists. And you had wars that went on for decades. You had the 30 Years' War, you had the 100 Years' War. Millions of Christians were killed in Europe over, between the Catholics and the Protestants and other groups as well, over religion. And Europe really suffered for centuries over religious conflict. And so out of that was born writers like John Locke and his famous Letter on Tolerance and Second Treatise of Government and the other people later who were trying to, look, how can we live together harmoniously in a space without being destroyed, literally killed by religious conflict? And so secularism was a European answer for many people to a particularly European experience of absolute horror, because Christianity at that time was extremely violent. You could literally be executed, burnt to death, or just killed, and it was indiscriminate killing. Millions of people, Europeans, died. And of course, this got exported globally as well. So my contention is this European obsession and paranoia about religious violence is rooted in our psyche as Westerners because of our past. And we are projecting this onto, say, Islam, and assuming, of course, it's a religion as well, therefore religions are like this. So we must tame, domesticate, we must make it private. Oh, yes, have your rituals, but don't bring it into the political sphere, because we had that in Europe. And when we had that in Europe, it killed tens of millions of people. So there's a logic to this. Although, of course, a sober analysis would say, hang on, because it happened here, it doesn't mean it's going to happen or even ever happened in the Muslim world, which, of course, doesn't have a history of persecution. It has a history of tolerance, actually. And people like John Locke actually acknowledge this. Adam Smith, the Scottish economist, wrote very highly of the Ottoman Empire and the polity there and the way people were integrate in society, Christians, Jews, non-Muslims and Muslims, of course. So this is even acknowledged by some intelligentsia in the West. But overall, we just assume religion is like this. Religion is a bad thing. Therefore, we must really domesticate it and privatize it and hopefully liberalize it, so it's not a threat anymore. But I think that's the origins of this Western obsession. And there is a logic to it, I'm just trying to say. It's not just an illusion.
No, absolutely. There is a logic, then there is a very important history that you've just very nicely outlined here. And I think, Paul, as you've also said here, I just want to further punctuate that, one of the underlying illusions, in fact, is that this religious past perhaps was eclipsed by the liberal secular state. I mean, even someone like Carl Schmitt, the famous German lawyer and theorist, famously argued
that all major concepts of modern politics are secularized theological concepts, most importantly, the modern state.
Yeah.
So when you had the theological divine that could announce the exception of the miracle, now it is the modern state that can announce the exception that some bodies and violence against them will be considered, and violence against other forms of bodies will not be even counted or even considered as worthy of reflection. And ultimately, the modern state, because of its very structure, and this is a point that was perhaps most forcefully made by the brilliant anthropologist, the brilliant late anthropologist, Professor Saba Mahmood, in her fantastic book, Religious Difference in a Secular Age, that the modern nation state, by its very nation, by its very nature, by its very structure, will always privilege majoritarian sensibilities, because the underlying purpose of the modern state is the maintenance of public order through the exercise of laws. And those laws, because their main purpose is the maintenance of order for the governance of the state, will by default always privilege majoritarian sensibilities. So why is it that encampments and, you know, some kind of interruption to public order when it came to pro-Palestine encampments at universities in the US became reason for the police to be called in, but no such police comes when it comes to other forms of protest or the kind of violence because of which the encampments were happening in the first place? So again, the maintenance of public order, and it was interesting that in the US this last few months, that the modern university basically became a microcosm of the modern state. Whereas you had these really courageous students and primarily students who, you know, engaged in protest, many of them, in fact, and on many campuses being led by Jewish students who were anti-Zionist. These institutions called the police on them, acting as a microcosm of the modern state, because when public order is disrupted, this kind of protest was not considered to be appropriate. Why? Because of the majoritarian sensibilities that privilege one form of suffering and death over another. This is just, I think, an important discussion to think about the ramifications of a book that is talking about intra-Muslim debates on inter-religious friendship. And very quickly, Paul, I just want to bring it back to the context of South Asia, but also to the present, how this whole thing relates to the present. So, in the epilogue, I talk about this very courageous and brilliant Muslim activist and thinker who is in his mid-30s at this point. His name is Sharjeel Imam, who since 2020 has been in prison in this high surveillance with awful conditions called the Tehar Jail in New Delhi. And he was basically imprisoned on charges of sedition in 2020 when he protested against those very racist laws that were proposed by the Indian government, known as the CAA and the NRC, which basically were extremely Islamophobic and xenophobic at the same time. So Sharjeel Imam was one of the main sort of organizers and became a key sort of figure in those protests. And at one point in one of his speeches, he said that we have to engage in roadblocks in order to further this cause. And he was charged with sedition and has been now in prison for the last almost 4.5 years. So I end the book with him, and in fact, the book is dedicated to him as well, because in that same speech towards the end, he made some very interesting comments. And those interesting comments relate back to this whole cow sacrifice debate that we were talking about a bit earlier. And Sharjeel Imam basically argued that when it comes to this whole debate on cow sacrifice and these intra-Muslim scholars who debated it 100 years ago, why is it that when it comes to schools and colleges and curricula and syllabi, and in terms of the reading sort of practices of the Indian public sphere, why is it that only one of the two arguments are considered and are sort of taught and are, in public circulation, even among Indian Muslims? And that argument is the argument for friendship with the Hindu other, collaboration with Gandhi, with the Indian National Congress, the argument of the Khilafat movement leaders. And why is it that the other viewpoint, which had its own nuanced kind of reasoning for why that kind of friendship was in fact politically catastrophic for Indian Muslims, the viewpoint of Ahmad Reza Khan, the founder of the Bareilvi School, why is that not taught? Why is that not in circulation? Why do we not know about it? And he says that we need to write our own history in ways that does not engage in this kind of a bifurcation between the good Muslims and the bad Muslims.
So I don't, by narrating this narrative, I don't mean to privilege or to authorize one argument over the other. I'm a student of religion. I've looked at both arguments as closely as possible, and then let the reader decide which argument they find more convincing. But I bring in someone like Sharjeel Imam to make the larger point that if we in fact are going to teach, if we in fact are going to take Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism seriously, to counter these phenomena, we must dissociate from the practice of then trying to find the good Muslims from the from a historical record, which is a lot more complex than this binary of the good Muslim and the bad Muslim. We have to take on its own terms those Muslim scholars, those Muslim figures from the past who don't sit that comfortably with our contemporary, primarily Western, but at this point really global, liberal, secular conceptions and sensibilities of what gets counted as a good religious subject, as a good Muslim, who is tolerant, harmonious, and it's all about, you know, peace and solidarity and so on. Peace and solidarity are not bad things, but when we engage in this kind of a exclusion of actors, scholars who don't sit that comfortably with liberal secular notions of good religion, in fact, that also is a subtle but perhaps even more pernicious form of Islamophobia than the open and all-out Islamophobia of, you know, the Zionists and others and so on. So this is a very important part of what I've tried to do in this book, is that, in fact, when it comes to those actors who may not sit comfortably with our contemporary liberal secular notions of good Muslims, we ought to take them seriously on their own terms. Not to romanticize them, not to glorify them, but to take their logics of argument, to take the logics of reasoning within the tradition of Islam seriously and on its own terms. So what someone like Sharjeel Imam, this contemporary young activist and scholar, his case really exemplifies is that, for example, Paul, recently there was elections in India in which the BJP, the current ruling Hindu nationalist government of Narendra Modi, did not win the same kind of majority that it desired and that it had sort of built a whole sort of public kind of a campaign around. And hence this result, although he still became prime minister, it's not that he lost the elections, but because he did not win it by the wide margins that he had previously, or even more than that, that was seen as a cause of this great celebration that, you know, the Indian liberal secular past has been retrieved and now the good days are coming and Hindu nationalism and exclusivism and violence against Muslims has been given a sound defeat and so on. Now, the interesting thing there is that if you look at someone like Rahul Gandhi, sort of the leader of the Indian National Congress, even in his comments after the elections, there is one group he never mentioned. He talked about the indigenous people and so on. But the one group, and he talked about the Dalits and the scheduled castes and so on. But the one group that he did not even mention are Muslims. And that is the level of pervasive Islamophobia that we find in a place like India today. So rather than celebrating that election sort of result, we really need to be very serious about ways in which these kinds of liberal secular celebrations of, you know, giving some kind of a defeat to Hindu nationalism, etc., also participates in a subtle but equally pernicious form of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism. That this guy, Rahul Gandhi, does not even mention the name of Muslims, and still it is being celebrated as some great victory against the nefariousness of Hindu nationalism. But to really regard the fact that the Indian state, or like any other modern nation state, in its very structuration, in its very sort of constitution, will be exclusionary towards non-Hindus. And to take very seriously and wrestle very seriously with this underlying contradiction of the modern state, which doesn't mean that the modern states will go away tomorrow. We have to live with them, but with a more critical eye, with a more critical perspective. So anyways, that in some ways is one aspect of how this book, which talks about intra-Muslim debates in a manner that does not bifurcate good and bad Muslims, is relevant to the politics of the present in places like India or even elsewhere for that matter.
Yeah, and I'll put a link to the book in the description below so people can read it for themselves. I'm just curious about the reception to your book since it's been published. Well, what kind of responses have you had from scholars and non-scholars or even non-academics? Have you had political responses to the work?
So it got published in September, Paul, and, you know, the last year, of course, has been an unprecedented last year. But there has been quite a lot of interest, especially among people, in fact, in diaspora communities in the UK. I was very recently at the Bradford Literature Festival, in which it was a full house. People came with books, and that was very heartening to see. And in some ways, interestingly, Paul, these intra-Muslim debates and traditions of sort of Muslim argument, I mean, they are very important even today in South Asia, but in fact, they're even more punctuated perhaps in the diaspora, and especially in the UK, especially when it comes to the Deobandi Bareilvi polemic that I talked about earlier in my first book, but even the second book, when it comes to this whole topic of interreligious friendship and how do you deal with the state that might be violent towards your religious principles, it's a question of tremendous political urgency in contexts like the UK, the US as well, and so on. Because in some ways, today's present is in some ways mirroring this context a century ago, where you have a state in which, you know, we exist as Muslims in the UK, in the US, and so on, which clearly has shown, we always knew about this, but has shown in the most brazen fashion possible, just how attached it is to a liberal secular project of genocide. To put it very, very clearly and bluntly, what has been happening here. I mean, the degree to which Palestinian lives have been left unconsidered as worthy of reflection, as worthy of some humanity, is not divorced from the fact that these are Muslim lives. I understand that we cannot reduce the situation and the conflict to religion. I understand that one cannot reduce it to religious sort of factors. But there is no question that this kind of heedlessness, this kind of violent indifference towards human suffering has a lot to do with the fact that in this case, it is Muslim human suffering. And this, in some ways, connects with the underlying liberal secular assumption that if you don't keep Islam in its place, it will spill over into violence. And that, in some ways, is the assumption which is driving the discourse of the American state, the UK state, all these other states which are in alliance with Israel. So in terms of the reception, I think, the UK audiences clearly are reading it and are responding quite favorably. Of course, this book and this topic is of existential significance to Indian Muslims today. And there might be two different camps where you have young scholars, you know, inspired by people like Sharjil Imam, who want to take religious traditions, Islamic knowledge tradition seriously on its own terms, not being governed and policed by these liberal secular kind of operations of what is a good Muslim. You know, one of the main problems, for example, in universities in India, for example, that I've come to know through my readership in India, is that at many of these elite universities, you know, Islam and Islamic intellectual traditions are not taken that seriously because that is seen as not properly, worthy of intellectual inquiry, because it's only subjects that don't take religious thought, theological debate seriously. That's properly academic, whereas this is all theology, right? And hence, I think the title of your blog is quite apt there. You're blogging and thinking theology and taking it seriously. In Pakistan, the Pakistan edition has not come out yet, but I presume that there as well, you would have people who are really, desirous of trying to understand these traditions and their own kind of past more seriously on its own terms. I mean, for example, myself, to sort of conclude with a more biographical note, you know, I don't come from a family of religious scholars. I did not go to an Islamic seminary. I, you know, got the kind of regular colonial education of the O-levels and the A-levels, and then went to university in the U.S., McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and then did a PhD in Islamic studies at Duke University. So I came at this topic also from a position of tremendous ignorance. And there was this moment when I realized at the end of my undergraduate education and in the beginnings of my graduate education that I, in fact, did not know any of these scholars about whom then I later wrote books about. I had not heard these names. I had not heard, you know, these institutions, the Deoband and the Bareilvi schools, their debates, who are these scholars and so on. And that made me realize, and that really made it very acute to me, the degree of my own colonized status. That I sort of wondered that, you know, coming from an upper middle class family, not even from the big cities, I'm from Quetta in southwest Pakistan, bordering Afghanistan and Iran. And so I'm not from some kind of a westernized English speaking sort of background, but even someone like me completely missed out this tradition. I had no idea who these people are, these traditions, these scholars. And that made me sort of think about ways in which, you know, what is this tradition then? What are its subtleties? And that made me much more sensitive to the degree to which these liberal secular assumptions of life, of taking religion suspiciously, taking religious actors suspiciously, how ingrained and how naturalized that is. And in some ways, my pursuit of Islamic studies then became a critique of that liberal secular naturalization of the othering of Muslim life, especially Muslim intellectual life. And again, the point here is not to take to give a free pass to every Muslim scholar, or to be uncritical, or to glorify, or to romanticize. That would be the polemical counter viewpoint. But to take seriously on its own terms this very sophisticated and complex intellectual tradition. Even if you want to critique it, even if you want to criticize it, you better understand it on its own terms. Your own critique might be more informed and might be more substantive from that perspective.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that. And the book in question, obviously, is called Perilous Intimacies, Debating Hindu-Muslim Friendship After Empire. Oh, no, a bit more.
Here. And then here you go.
Yeah, there we go.
I've run out of author copies of my US edition.
But, yeah, that's not the cover I'm familiar with from Amazon.
You have the US edition, the first edition. This is the India edition. I've run out of author copies.
Oh, really? Oh, gosh. You run out of copies. Gosh, that popular. That's good news.
Very gifted to people, but yeah.
Really? Gosh. Well, I'll link to it in the description below. So I read the first chapter. It is actually a very interesting read. And I'm very grateful that you've taken time out to talk to us today about your work. And you're flying back to America soon, I understand. And there's much, and I know even having read that one chapter, there's much more you could have discussed and mentioned and talked about. It's a veritable cornucopia of treasures, your book. So I do recommend people have a look at it and read it. It is a scholarly work, of course. I'm not, we have to say that it is an academic work. It's not a popular paperback. It is a work of scholarship and written in that style as well. But if one can access that, then there's much to benefit and be enlightened in that work, I think. So, what I can say is thank you very much indeed for your time, and look forward to reading future works by you as well, inshallah.
Thank you, Paul. This was such a honor to be here, and you asked some such incredible questions, and you are an author's delight in terms of the close reading you've done. I'm really, really honored and pleased to be here. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum to you. Thank you very much.
Wa alaikum assalam.